Hello and welcome to Live Q&A 20, totally professional workplace environment and stream setup that worked seamlessly. Hey, how's it going? How's it going, Andrew?
It is going technically fantastic. That's the most important part.
Oh, good stuff. So while I'm loading up our fine patron questions, I actually had a listener Thomas S. question, and I have some amount of pull around this place, so at least can get my question. So I was watching a cop show, murder copy, crimey, whatever show, and I was thinking, you know, oftentimes the plot twist is like, oh, it's a family member of the police officer. And I was thinking, how would the search rules apply? Let's say your investigator, Detective Matthew Maxson or something. And it turns out, you somebody you live with, like your family, maybe it's your wife, maybe it's whatever. They are the serial killer you've been looking for all along. If you're a cop, I was thinking, like, hypothetically, you could just search your entire house, and maybe if it's a roommate, I don't know if there's some questioning, questionable thing there. Maybe you can't go in there, but like, couldn't you just search the whole house, everything, any evidence you want, and then just be like, oh, I was just doing some cleaning, found all this evidence, you know? Like, what would the rules behind that be?
Yeah, so the actual rule to that is that you can consent to whatever, right?
You can grant the consent
to the police searching on your property. And so
what if you're in a co-shared go ahead. Sorry.
I know. I was just going to say, like, where this comes up all the time are in rental units with college kids, right? Like, the landlord will often say, oh yeah, I'm going to let the cops come into the premises. And as far as I know, unless you have taken steps to, lock out the landlord and, assert your expectation of privacy, then they can consent on your behalf.
Wow, even so, just any landlord? That feels a little bit, that feels a little, I don't know what, intrusive, I guess, or like, but I guess if you're the landlord, you can just consent to having the tenant's place searched at any time? I don't know.
So now we're kind of moving into a speculative area that I'm less certain about, but, the touchstone of any inquiry here is going to be whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, right? And so things that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy about in the landlord-tenant context that I know about, I've read some of these cases, are suppose you have a 3-bedroom suite, right? And you have 3 different, kids in college who have each rented out a bedroom, but they're all on the lease together, and then there's a common area, right? I know that there are cases in which, like, just one of the tenants, right, is like, oh yeah, sure, come on in and search the common area. That's totally fine. Then inevitably that's when you discover something about your roommates that you didn't previously know about. And then with respect to the landlord letting you in, I think the real question there would be how consistent is it with the landlord's right to enter the premises, right? And that's going to vary lease by lease. I mean, you do have, a general right to exclude, but for example, one of the things that's common in a residential lease is to say that the landlord can enter the premises, at any time to make repairs or in an emergency or, with a certain kind of notice when it's getting time to relet the premises. So I think there'd be, lots of ways in which your hypothetical cop could be able to, broadly authorize himself to go searching.
All right. Well, that's it for my question. As usual, we need to start off our Q&A with our ceremonial Teresa Gomez question, because she always gets there first and asks the first question. If you could be a guest on any podcast and talk about any topic, which one would you choose?
Ooh, well, why don't we have that an Ask Thomas first? Because I'd love to know. Oh. I mean, other than this show, right, obviously.
But I would, I don't know if this will be the best answer, but I would love to go on one of these jerk-off intellectual dark web podcasts and actually argue for progressive and social justice politics in a what I think is an intelligent way, because they never do that. All they do is complain, like maybe Sam Harris or something. All they do is complain about how nobody will have the conversations with them or whatever it is. Right. And then they never actually go out and actually find a liberal progressive to have an argument with. So maybe I would do that just because it would be really challenging. It would take a lot of prep to make sure I was on my game, because especially with something like that, where they never give people like that a shot. So a lot would feel like it was riding on it, but that's probably what I would do.
Yeah. I like that a lot. And I think you'd be fantastic at, going on Sam Harris or Dave Rubin or something like that. For me, I mean, my go-to when people, really ask this is, I would love to have a conversation with Rachel Maddow, right? I'd like to, that's just somebody that I think is so adjacent to what we're doing. But in particular, what I'd like to have that conversation about is about jurisprudence, right? And kind of sounding the alarm on what this court is doing, which is what we do most weeks, but in a way that really is able to sort of focus the attention on the process and not just the outcomes. So that would be my answer. And thanks, nice. Teresa.
I also would want to be on a season of Serial as a dead body, because I got – no, I'm just kidding.
obviously, turn my,
if I murder, turn right? it like, into yeah. a really good podcast. That's what I'm saying. Make all the money on it. I volunteer. If I'm murdered, you can do a podcast about that.
Yeah, we should have picked that.
Spoiler, it was Eli.
Where should we be? We should be on the show that gets 90 million downloads. Yeah. Yes, that's where we should be.
Here's a good one. Bird Lawyer Esquire asks, conservative legal scholars frequently talk about the unitary executive theory and the need for a strong executive branch. Has this been consistent through the years, or does it only apply under Republican presidents? Well, it was 8 years of not that, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah. That is, obviously totally inconsistent with the cries over, executive overreach under Obama that, we don't need to go through. But I will point out that insofar as there is kind of a weight of history, right, that weight of history in the past 50 years has been warning about the aggregation of power in the hands of the executive, right? Like, and if you care about original intent, right, it's very, very clear when you go back and read the Federalist Papers and when you look at, the first 50 years of the country, right? Like that they really had the view of the president as like kind of a figurehead, right? Like, yes, it was important that we had a unitary voice to represent us in, international affairs.
Plus back then, it might've been, do you think they were more like, he's going to be the guy, the general in charge of our army, cause there's more about, if somebody attacks us or there might, there's going to be a lot more conflict. I feel like the war aspect would have been a bigger part of the presidential responsibility. Is that right or wrong?
No, I think that's right. I also think, remember we separated ourselves from a monarchy, right? And so, when you read the Federalist Papers, like there were a not insignificant number of, people in the United States that were, arguing for a hereditary monarchy, right? Like arguing for, right? Like everything was sort of on the table at the time. And, we went in a different direction for good or for ill, but no, like that was part of it. And in particular, I think the discussions that, we've had on our show over, Trump's bogus state of emergency, right? And the vote that's going to take place. I think it's going to take place in the Senate tomorrow. I know. I just saw a news item flash that Rand Paul is going to join other Republicans in voting against, voting for the House resolution to disapprove of the emergency. That will do nothing, by the way, because Trump is just going to veto it. But it has political implications. Anyway. When you look at the states of emergency powers, and you look at the fact that both Korea and Vietnam were police actions, right? That the weight of history of the second half of the 20th century to today, so right, the past 70 years, has been that the executive's power is growing out of control and is totally out of whack. And I think we're going to see all those arguments resurrected in 2 years when we get a Democrat back in the White House.
How much do you care? First off, what do you think is the most powerful branch right now? Because it feels like it's the Supreme Court oftentimes. But I mean, I guess by extension, the president gets to appoint justices. So, you know, maybe that means the executive is the strongest. But like, and also, how much do you care about this? Because in a world, in a country we live in now where Congress just can't do anything, maybe all the power should just be in the presidency. I don't know. Because otherwise nothing's going to happen forever. What do you think?
Well, and I think, right, I think you answered that question kind of by process of elimination, right? Like the Republicans have broken the legislature. And it used to be that we pass laws and now we don't pass
laws.
Well,
you know, did you end up reading or hearing somebody, it's Identity Crisis, I think it was. Is that? No, not Identity Crisis. What's the one that I just read that was about, it's this theory, did I talk about this? Where the reason nothing's happening in Congress is actually because for so long throughout American political history, one party has been more dominant. And so when one party's just like controlled Congress, you know, Democrats controlled Congress for decades. And so the game theory thing is like, okay, well, you work for compromise. But now we're in a position where it's 50-50. Like every election for president is 50-50. So the incentives are never work with the other side at all, because you can just campaign on them getting nothing done and then win the next election and do your agenda then. And I actually think that sounds pretty plausible. Did you catch that book or that?
I have not. That sounds pretty plausible. And I would add that as always, my favorite topic to blame of gerrymandering factors into that very, very heavily, right? Like you are reaching a point where, you know, with a 99%, I mean, look, incumbency has always been really, really high, but now with virtually every district gerrymandered as safe Republican or safe Democrat, now your biggest risk is losing in the primary, and the other side has a like, and again, and this is a both sidesism. We should be fair on it, right? Activists of both parties do not want compromise.
And I think so, I'm thinking of Insecure Majorities is the book, I believe.
I'll have to check it out. I haven't seen it, but it seems plausible to me. And again, I would add that I think that the political dynamic of your base would rather you hold strong than compromise, right? Like, I mean, look, I could illustrate this right now to our chat room. Like if you could pass an amendment to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that would protect sexual orientation and gender identity as part of the protected class, but the cost of doing so was you had to give Trump $7 billion for his stupid border wall.
Oh,
right?
I mean,
somebody put up a poll, right? Like, and again, it wouldn't be hard to demonstrate that, right? That the politically astute move is with your base, even on the left, right, is probably not do a thing if doing that thing also means enabling.
Are you serious? Because I would 100% take that deal. What are you
I would take
about?
That too, but my guess is that that the votes go the other way. Stormy Decisis says, can the $7 billion be gay? That would be great. I'm picturing a big rainbow bill that
That's weird because I don't – I mean I feel like we – I don't know if you're right about that, because that was exactly what Schumer and Pelosi were willing to do for DACA, just for DACA, was give him plenty of money. And, you know, Trump, amazing deal, most brilliant strategist that he is, didn't make the deal happen then and then waited until he lost the midterms and then tried to shut down the government to get – and did shut down the government to get less money than they had in that original fucking deal because he's a fucking idiot. God. All right.
Our group is saying would compromise. So
I think they would, but the reality is we probably wouldn't even get a deal like that. I don't think. Yeah. Go ahead.
And look, and my evidence, I've talked about this on the show before, but part of my evidence for this is the demonization of the crime bill of 1994 that took place in the 2016 Democratic primaries, right? I mean, that was – I can't tell you the number of people who said, well, I couldn't possibly vote for Hillary when she voted for the crime bill of 1994.
Voted for the
there was
she,
well,
how did you – hold on. How did she vote for the crime bill of 1994?
Right.
I would like
to know. Yeah, no, I know. Well, yeah. Right. I'm glad you're pointing out that that slight flaw in the logic. But look, like that bill, like, yeah, there was lots of terrible stuff in that bill. You also got 26 Republican senators to vote for comprehensive gun control, right? Like, yeah. You can weigh out, you know, the issues how you want, but when you use it as a purity test, right, of if you voted for this bill, you were voting for
– I totally agree with you on this, and it's one of those things too where
Americans.
I think people are very unfair in that they apply today's knowledge to a decision made at the time. At the time, I think a lot of people thought this was the best way to help black people in – there was a lot of black support. I'm pretty sure the black caucus supported that bill because – one of the side effects of being black and in poverty and in, you know, and that kind of thing is you don't want there to be a crime around you all the time either. So like a lot of black leaders at the time agreed with increased police presence as a way to help other black people who wanted to not be living in crime. Now, it turns out that the way that bill went about it was not the best way to do it and indeed had racist consequences. But I think that's something that people are learning, you know, like that wasn't people. I think you need to treat the vote how it should have been. You can't treat a vote in 1994 as though they knew all the consequences that would happen and intended them with that vote. Like you have to, if you're looking for the character of a person, you know what I mean? Don't you think you have to look
for what they wanted
to accomplish at the time. But anyway, and it's fine to say it was wrong. I'm not saying you can't say it was wrong. It's just, it's a little different than thinking, they voted for that because they wanted to be this racist police. It's like, no, I don't think that's what it was. But anyway, here's a good question by Bobson Dugnet, one of my favorite names. Recently, you've talked about how the Supreme Court has used procedural methods to reach decisions they want. While this is obviously bad in the short term, could the method of not ruling on the merits make it easier to overturn those results in the future? Great question.
So, great question and true. And I often describe that as sort of the best possible outcome that overlaps, I think, with the, you know, the John Roberts institutional thesis. I want to talk about that specifically because I think that's what we're looking at as the best case scenario in the Bladensburg Cross case. I wanted to mention this on the show. I'm going to go back to that in a second. But before we start talking about procedural. I mean, let's remember that, you know, this court just handed down last term the Janus versus Ask Me decision, right? Which was not narrowly confined on procedure. It was just, you know what? Abood versus Detroit, 41-year-old opinion, but Samuel Alito doesn't like it, so let's completely rewrite the rules. It does not, in my view, mean that this court is still not activist in terms of rewriting the rules. Now, back to the Bladensburg Cross case, having had a chance to see the oral arguments and debrief with some friends of the show who were also at the oral argument. I think I can say Andrew Seidel, right? Like he and I chatted about it afterwards. If you guys saw my speech, the most dangerous aspect of that case is that the petitioners were asking the Supreme Court to overrule Lemon versus Kurtzman and replace it with a test that literally I could not come up with a thing that it would prohibit that was not compulsory church attendance. Right. I mean, it's a terrifying thing. That question got asked by Elena Kagan of the Jones Day lawyer who was representing the American Legion, and he fumbled it pretty badly. He really couldn't come up with like, okay, well, what does your coercion test prohibit that did not render the Establishment Clause essentially a nullity? Now, that's still going to get the votes from, you know, the Howler Monkey contingent, but I'm a little bit, it gave
me... Howler Monkey contingent. You mean four out of the nine justices?
I mean, four out of the nine justices.
I mean, we're one away from entire majority Howler Monkey. Cool. Yeah.
Yes. But I mean, you know, sneak preview for those who are here in the live Q&A, this week we are going to talk about a truly terrifying dissent from Thomas that got Alito's vote that really lays bare sort of where the right wing of this court wants to go. It's a terrifying place. So they are still doing lots of non-procedural stuff. But yes, the procedural opinions, right? And that is like the reversal in the initially in the Wisconsin gerrymandering case. I'd rather the Supreme Court punt on everything and issue as narrow an opinion as possible, because otherwise the substantive rules that they're going to come up with are going to be awful. And, you know, again, it not 100%, but 90%.
And I agree. However, I also want to point out there are times when it doesn't matter because the damage is done. Like that guy was executed. Doesn't matter how stupid of a, you know, procedural ruling it is, that's over. And also something like Bush v. Gore, you know, which something like that could come up in the Trump era, I would think, where it's a huge decision that, you know, they just use some technicality to go the way they want to go. So, okay. Jim asks, are laws like those in Texas that require state government contractors to sign an oath that they won't boycott the state of Israel constitutional? Very interesting.
Yeah, I thought we talked about that on an episode, but
you know, I don't remember that.
So,
chat, let me know if I'm wrong.
Yeah. So there is, there has been some misreporting on that. These are provisions that require certain actions by subcontractors on government contracts, right? So the way in which a government contract works is you get the prime bidder for whatever it is that they're doing, and then the prime will subcontract out various parts of that to certain subcontractors, and that goes into the bidding process. The contract requires that the subcontractors, who are corporate entities, right, engage in, you know, these activities. But it absolutely does not interfere with the free speech rights of the individuals who are a part of those subcontractors, right? So, and I know that the person who signed the contract says, you know, well, I feel like I can't, you know, sign on to this oath of not boycotting Israel because it's a political belief. But that individual contract, I've looked at it, directly involved, she signed on behalf of the corporate entity. So let's do that really, really, let me make that as clear as I can. I could sign a contract with our advertisers that says, Opening Arguments Media LLC will not endorse a candidate for president, right? And we could abide by that. That wouldn't prevent me, Andrew Torres, from in, you know, other aspects of my life, right, not on the show, saying I support Elizabeth Warren for president, right? I probably wouldn't sign that deal, by the way. Like, I don't know that there are ads that are worth us giving up our independence. But, you know, they throw enough money at us, maybe. But, but you know, in other words, the story got a lot of traction, and it particularly got a lot of traction in because it seemed to co-opt both the sort of free speech left and the anti-Muslim right. And when I looked into the specific contract, right, you can say that your contractor cannot, you know, refuse to do business with the state of Israel. To me, that, you know, when you kind of put the parameters on it, that makes it, you know, more defensible.
Okay. You know, here's one that I think you can answer pretty quickly that just it might be a refresher for everybody who's been following this for so long. A sourdough starter who has achieved sentience asks, what is the point of using individual one and organization one, et cetera, in the court filings when we all pretty much know or can figure out who they're talking about? So what is the exact procedural point of that?
Yeah. So here's the right. Yeah. When it says, Michael Cohen worked for the organization, the presidential campaign of individual one, and then the next says individual one became president of the United States. That's not too hard to figure out, who they're talking about. The reason that you do that is because when you have the grand jury issues an indictment, if they name you as an individual, then your Sixth Amendment rights apply to that, right? Mm. And so the grand jury is going to be exceedingly cautious about who they identify and on what grounds, because all those due process rights start attaching. And until that point, when you're just referred to as individual one or organization one or whatever, then you can't go back and claim Sixth Amendment rights in connection with that. And that means, so that's why typically they do that prior to certain indictments being handed out, right? So Roger Stone was previously referred to as individual one or individual two in, I think, but I'm trying to remember whose indictment that was.
Why can't they do cool nicknames like the Secret Service or like insulting nicknames like Crimey McCrimeface, like can't stop criming. Yeah, something for
the Mongooses. Manafort. That's a cool name. That's a great one. I don't know any reason why they couldn't use, right? Like I've talked to other lawyers who have done filings that have had John and Jane Doe filings, right? And I asked. Well, and in fact, I've when I represented Lloyd's of London, they will often add Doe's fictitious Doe's on the defendants because you're about to name the individual names who are in a particular state and they don't know who they are yet. But I have asked my lawyer friends, like, have you ever been tempted, right, instead of, Jane Doe, having it be, Blanche Boxwoman or whatever? And I've never gotten a good answer on that. So
here's why I love this this question and a comment on it. Anxiously waiting for Mueller to play his trump card. Nice. Weird hypothetical. What would happen if a criminal defendant behaved in such a way that there was truly no defense attorneys willing to represent him? For instance, he demands that he will testify, but also tells each prospective attorney that he will commit perjury. Would the defendant ever be forced to represent himself pro se? And then Donald Wisenhunt got in there and said, this is not a hypothetical. My friend's ex-husband is so bad that he can't get a lawyer to represent him. He's been filing motion after motion about child custody. He has threatened and sued multiple judges across two states. His blog and memes border on threats, but never quite enough, although they are far worse than Stone's Insta. And the FBI did raid his house, but no charges were filed. The judge in New York wanted to hold a trial hearing and find him in contempt, but he has literally threatened all the lawyers in the small town, and the judge canceled the hearing. Holy crap. We've got your new TV show right there.
Yeah, that's another Lord Awful Movies better than anything we've actually seen.
Eventually the government just makes somebody do it, right? Isn't that the answer?
No, well, so a couple of things, right? Number one, there's a fair amount of jurisprudence on this when people have kind of abused court-appointed counsel, right? And the cases are really all over the map when somebody is like, I don't want to have this lawyer represent me anymore. And the lawyer will say, that's great. I don't want to represent him anymore either. And there's, sort of a complicated line of jurisprudence with respect to that. But on the initial question of if you're just such an impossible jerk that like you are trying to get counsel to represent you, but failing, right? Then eventually, right, I think the court will put hard deadlines on, because think about how this would work in practice, right? Like you are required to show up for your hearing. And what you would do is you would file some kind of motion to postpone or reschedule. And you would say, Your Honor, I'm trying to get a lawyer. I just hired somebody yesterday. The hearing's in 2 days. He's not going to be prepared. I need 2 weeks. And eventually the court will just say,
nah.
Yeah, no, that, yeah, like okay. You've gone through 8 lawyers, like this is, you know, be in court. The area where this would be really, really interesting, as long as we're inventing, you know, legal movies here, is that works for you as an individual. It doesn't work as a corporation, ooh, right? A corporation cannot represent itself pro se.
Oh, corporations aren't people, my friend.
That's an area in which they're not people, right? Ah. They cannot represent themselves pro se, and they must be represented in court by an attorney. Wow. And so
corporation, PG&E, you know, what if they, in order to avoid this whole fire mess, they're like, we can't find a lawyer. It's impossible. And they just never...
It would be such a neat, and I suspect in that case that you would just have, right, the court would appoint a lawyer and allow that lawyer to decide the case.
We're making a movie. You have him shocked to death. I don't know.
but let me add, I mean, this is slightly ancillary to it, but I think related. One of the things that definitely happens, I've talked about billion-dollar, you know, corporation-on-corporation litigation. One of the key battles in those mega cases of the kind that I used to do are battles over expert witnesses, right? And one of the things both sides, that corporations definitely do, is they hire all of the experts in the field, even the ones that they don't want to testify, in order to lock them up so that they can't represent the other side.
Okay. Hold on. Now, this is a genuinely good idea. Now, they do that, and then someone has to, like, become an expert and, like, study up and find a way to be a compelling expert for a subject. And it's a real underdog story. Maybe it's somebody who failed out of college or something. Just has to, I don't know. Just something. That's awesome. Okay, I'm going to do the thing that we always do when we're getting in the, you know, in the second half of this, which is I'm going to go to the bottom and try to reward some of the newer questions because they didn't have time for people to vote. Here's one I can just tackle real quick because it's a repeat question, but I think it's an interesting one. Every episode, Christopher Arguin asks, every episode ends with Andrew saying that the theme song was made by Thomas and used with his permission. Who is that for? I think Thomas knows and wants to. Yeah, no, this is awesome. Andrew answered this before, and it's because if he didn't do that, then the song would just be assumed to be Opening Arguments property instead of my property. So it's actually very nice that Andrew does that. So thank you, Andrew. Much appreciate.
You're very welcome. Thank you for giving me permission to use the song.
Yeah, yeah. Jennifer Hodges asks, would someone in Puerto Rico have standing to sue for representation in Congress? I assume not, but what would prevent that? Has it ever been attempted?
So I don't know the – right. I mean the answer is definitely no because otherwise it would have been attempted. And I don't know off the top of my head – but I suspect it's because the Constitution defines, right? Puerto Rico is a territory, right? And I don't think in history any U.S. territory has ever had representation in Congress, right? Like you have a territorial governor, but you don't have, you don't get members of Congress, you don't get senators. And I think that's pretty clear from the structure of Article 1, right, that says how – that uses the term state, right? So that's where in my – like as I'm sort of putting this together, if you were to argue – right? So number one, there's no clear cause of action. You could say I'm suing under the like – Republican government clause, right? Something like that. Like, you know, I'm a part of the United States, but I don't have a voice in the government. And then the government would move to dismiss on the grounds that those representation rights are left to capital S states, and Puerto Rico isn't a state.
Mm. Dang. All right. Here's a huge one. Controversial, really important. Amicus brief or amicus brief? This is a huge Andrew split. Andrew, we got Andrew Torres on amicus brief and Andrew Seidel on amicus. I gotta say, if I could be the tie-breaking vote, amicus just sounds so much nicer. Amicus brief sounds like, oh, it's nice to flow. Amicus brief, it's like, what? That doesn't... It sounds horrible, but I don't know if there's some rules of pronunciation of whatever language that is that'll tell me I'm wrong. Latin, yeah. I don't know.
I have heard very fine lawyers, including the inestimable Mr. Seidel on both sides of that. I obviously am a big fan of amicus, but I will say the strongest argument for amicus is the plural, right? I always just say amicus briefs, but it is when it's plural, like the Latin plural is A-M-I-C-I. And I think you pronounce that amici, right? Hmm. Which, right? So that's
rather
the best
than
argument
amici
for the other side.
Yeah.
Amici, that doesn't, that amici. I've never heard anybody say amici. So, so that would be the best argument for the other side, but I still think they're wrong.
Do you have to pluralize that word? Like, you know, isn't that a modifier? Well, whatever.
That's right. So you would say, but you pluralize it. I have pluralized it in writing before when you say, you know, amici agree that, right? Mm. Because, you know, you're writing a brief on behalf of multiple parties that are all friend of the court. So.
Well, that's a very, I mean, like you said, fine lawyers on both sides, but that's a big one. And I vote amicus because it sounds nicer. Okay, let me get another one here. I'm trying to make sure we're getting toward the end, so I want to make sure we select ones here. Rinnick asks, as requested, you got to share your story topper for the Cleveland lawyer that got punched in the face by his client in the courtroom after getting sentenced to 47 years. Wait, did you reference that, or I'm not understanding the syntax of that question? But
so yeah, somebody was talking about how there was a case. Client got sentenced to, I guess, 47 years in prison, and then, you know, punched his lawyer in the face afterwards.
Yeah, I saw.
And I said, I think I got a story topper for that one. It is one, Thomas, you will remember because I told it, I think, in the very first Q&A. But we've got lots of new listeners since then, so I can recycle that story a little bit. It's the very first case that I ever worked on. I was a first year law student. I was a 1L.
Is this that family that, or no, yeah. the hitman, yep. Right?
Well, No. That's my actual client. I was a real lawyer, I had a client who his ex-business partners hired the Russian mafia, but like the discount Russian mafia. So they got a guy with, you know, trembly, he was like 70 years old and trembling arm, and he shot my client at point blank range and missed his vitals, hit him in the leg. That was pretty bad. But that didn't have any consequences for the lawyer. the other than I got a call on Christmas and had to go to the hospital for my client, which is really sad. But no, the biggest like cautionary lawyer story that I know that I think is even worse than, you know, getting punched in the face was, I was a first year law student working as a 1L summer associate, on a creditor in a bankruptcy. And it involved, this rich guy. I always call him Angus because he's old, but I think I'm confusing him with the main independent governor, Angus King. But anyway, his last name was King, and he owned the single most valuable piece of contiguous real estate on the Eastern Seaboard. It was, for those of you who are in the DC area, the triangle formed by the Capitol Beltway, 270 and 355 Rockville Pike. And so it was this unbelievably valuable piece of real estate. And like a lot of incredibly rich old guys, he'd, you know, disinherited one of his sons and liked the other one. And he was like 106 years old and had this piece of property, and lots of developers wanted to buy it, and he wanted it to go to some kids, but not others. And so, if he had just died, then because we have no real estate tax, it would have been just fine. But instead, he didn't want to die and get the benefit that way, but he still didn't want to pay taxes on this super valuable piece of property while transferring it to some kids, but not the others. And so he hired an idiot lawyer to who advised him to declare the property farmland and then appraise the sale as farm, because, you know, there wasn't anything on it. And so they appraised it as like farmland at a value of like $4,000. Transferred out the property, and then the IRS actually opened up an investigation because the Washington Post ran
because
a story
it wasn't the Trump family, so they actually had to follow up and, you know, punish them, and because this is exactly what Trump did, right?
I mean, right? Yes, yeah, and so much. They opened up the investigation, and because they were looking, they were like, I don't recall the single most valuable piece of contiguous property on the Eastern Seaboard being transferred and us getting paid for it. Also, this was the 1980s. So, you know, there was still IRS enforcement back then. Yeah. They opened up an investigation. Of course, there was a massive real estate bust in the late 1980s. And so the property was worth half of what it was worth at the time. And based on the assessed value at the time, the treble damages, interest, and back pay exceeded the value of this once billion-dollar piece of property.
Wow. And
so the entire thing was forfeit, was annexed by the city of Rockville. I've had friends who live in what is now called King Farm in an utterly unironic sort of way. But he lost absolutely everything on the result of bad lawyering.
All to avoid some taxes, right?
All like, to avoid taxes.
Maybe just pay your taxes, folks. Here's an interesting one by Gary Myers. Where is the line between blackmail and just applying leverage?
Okay. So as we mentioned, the
I hope this is not for you know, like they're planning something.
Yeah. This don't is all hypothetical, take legal right? Advice yeah. from this podcast. Yeah. We've talked about this before, that these the difference, right? There's a federal blackmail statute. There are state statutes. But typically at the core of each one is some kind of threat of violence or threat of or improper means, right? And that's the easiest differential in terms of what counts as the distinction between, you know, blackmail and leverage. So for example, here, let me pull up the Maryland statute, you know, right now. It's 3-701.
Brian chimed in. I feel like this is dangerous. The line is, if you use audio clips in a podcast, that's definitely blackmail. Just a weird law thing. That's illegal for some reason.
Well, yes. And so here's how Maryland, for example, defines extortion. They say you may not obtain, attempt to obtain, or conspire to obtain money, property, labor, services, or anything of value. That's as broad as it gets from another person with their consent, if the consent is induced by the wrongful use of actual or threatened 1, force or violence, 2, economic injury, or 3, and then this has to deal with immigration status. So, you know, that's kudos to the state for identifying that as a specific area. But notice the form of that is the basics of what you want, which is wrongful use as opposed to not wrongful use. And, you know, where's that line? That's going to be on a case-by-case basis. And number 2, that it has to be some kind of injury, be it a physical or an economic injury. So that's where your line would be.
It's interesting. So I just wonder how meaningless of a thing or like how small of a thing this could be. You know, if it's like, you know, I better be elected president of the book club, Andrew. I better have your vote or I'm going to tell, you know, somebody about something you did that's slightly embarrassing. You know, like, is that level of kind of nothing, but it still technically could be blackmail or what? What would be the threshold?
Yeah, I mean, they're right. That would be an issue for the jury to decide. right? Now,
in, this is a very important book case, club, though.
It's highly unlikely that a prosecutor would
bother.
would bring charges.
What if you file charges or whatever? Okay. All right. Okay. This is kind of a funny one that'll be fun to read. Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU3L. I feel like you've had that name for more than a year. Is it just me?
Yeah.
Are you still?
I think so too. We've given Milo a couple shout outs too. So.
Yeah. It's been a while, but, hopefully you're a 4L or do you just, are you done after that? I don't know. Question for Andrew. I'm currently sitting in my pre-trial ad class listening to my professor tell a story about an attorney he knew. Whenever he took deposition with the attorney on the other end of the phone, he would constantly hear the toilet flushing every hour or so, maybe more often as he got older. He finally asks, "What the hell is going on?" And the attorney said he had so many depositions every day that he spent most of it on the toilet. What's the weirdest or most oddly endearing thing you've ever seen as a regular practice from another attorney?
So, that's super strange. I mean, he's got to have some kind of like, personal injury, like minor accident practice, right? Because doing multiple depositions in a day is a challenge. Doing them, via telephone. I've never conducted a deposition via telephone. I can't imagine ever wanting to. And obviously doing it from the toilet, that goes without saying. Weird. So, okay. The weirdest thing that comes to mind immediately is I had a partner at Covington and Burling who shall not be named because I think he's still there. And
Mr.
He and I,
Covington.
Yes.
Oh, no,
yeah.
Not that. Okay.
And he and I did a 3-week trial together and for, I am not kidding, 11 days in a row, right? Because we're at trial and what you do is, you're working all day and all night, as soon as court recesses at about 5 o'clock, we would go back to the hotel and we would work for another 5 or 6 hours. I mean, it's just sort of how trials work. And for 11 nights in a row, he ordered pizza. And and I'm not a big, pizza guy to begin with, and days.
You don't like pizza, or you just recognize how unhealthy it is? Because pizza,
doesn't hit that here's the thing, right? When I think of stuff that I would like that's worth the caloric intake, pizza's not there, right? Beer is definitely there, right? Mozzarella sticks, onion rings.
Mozzarella, yeah, no. That's emptier than pizza. At least with pizza, you get some.
But it's a higher reward, in my view. It's a higher taste.
You're crazy. Because I feel like pizza is mozzarella sticks plus some other good stuff. You know what I mean? Okay, well. This is
onion
a professional
rings.
Disagreement,
are
you know, this is, we're
going
to have to work through this as a partnership and as a show. But, I'm willing to work through it if you are, but.
Yeah, we'll get some counseling. Yeah.
Let's focus that we agree on amicus sounds better. I think that'll unite the
yes,
show.
Yes, there we go. Let's hold it together. We don't want them to see mommy and daddy.
By the way, want to say hi to Adam Reeks of course, the Herd Mentality podcast in the chat.
Woo!
Thanks for stopping by, Adam. Long time no see or talkie, but it's really good to see your
we
little
love
avatar
Adam.
There. Good times. Time for a couple more, or did I interrupt you?
No, yeah. So anyway, it was like I'm like, we have to get some food that is not pizza. And he was like, I don't understand why you would do that when we could just have pizza.
he weigh 418 pounds?
No, he was like 135.
Oh, so it's
too.
One of those people that's why he eats pizza every day, because he has that metabolism where he doesn't get fat. So he's just like, why don't we all eat pizza every single meal? What are you talking about? I guess if there was no getting fat or being unhealthy nutrition wise, I mean, I could probably eat pizza once a day, every day, I think. I don't think I'd be, I'm never, I mean, maybe twice a day would be too much, but like if I've gone to sleep and woken up, I can be like, pizza would be good today, every day, probably. Same with ice cream. I could eat ice cream 300 to 500 times a day and never get tired of it. It's the best. It's so good.
Oh, and Stormy Decisis in the chat says pineapple on pizza is delicious, which I totally agree.
I agree too. There we go.
Good.
You there get to put whatever you fucking don't listen to these fucking Nazis telling you what you can't put on your pizza. Whatever you want goes on your goddamn pizza. It's fine. If you like it, God, listen to these people. Sorry. Ooh, yep. Pineapple didn't shut up.
Yeah. Oh, good. We're in total agreement. And one more to our longstanding friend of the show, Liz Weeks, who points out how amazing Doritos are. And that is really, really high. She's got Bring Back Doritos 3D, Liz 2020. I could I want to subscribe to that organization.
What is that? Doritos 3D.
Doritos 3D were like puffed out Doritos. They were kind of like halfway between Doritos
as opposed to the two-dimensional Doritos I was eating. I almost want the two-dimensional ones because I feel like those couldn't make me fat. So, you know, because they can't. I'm not sure how you would interact with them. But anyway, here we go. I had a – oh, no. Where did I go? I lost it. Where did I – oh, I lost the question. I don't know what I did. I scrolled down. Well, let me – I think this one is good. Stormy Decisis asks, if I challenge my neighbor to thumb wrestle me with our hands in my mailbox, what? Assuming it's the kind that opens on both sides, then during the match I flip open the syringe of poison that I've been hiding and stab my neighbor's unsuspecting thumb, would it be a state or federal crime? What? I love it. It's one of those riddles for you to is extreme technicality time.
Yep, but turns out there's a super easy answer to that. That's a state crime. It is a federal crime to tamper with the mails, I don't think.
But like the mailbox isn't like federal airspace.
Yeah, so
the mailbox itself, that tiny like you know rectangular three dimensional space, isn't like official property of the airspace.
Yeah, no, it's
of
not. It does
government.
Not work like international waters. No,
you could if you could fit a little casino in there, you could like go gamble because. You like a mini.
Oh, that'd be great.
Maybe you all put your mailboxes together in a big enough thing. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
This may be a bigger thing you want to touch on in a show because I've heard a lot of people talking about this. But Mike Copen, maybe tell me in the chat if you're here, if I have that right. Can a person's citizenship be revoked? And I think it's important to talk about, obviously, which country you're talking about. But there is an ex-ISIS person in the news who wants to come back into the country but is being denied by the government. I see this as a test case to be used against immigrants who are born here but their parents are illegal immigrants. This would enable them to strip citizenship from people they don't like. I see this as an end run on birthright citizenship that the administration doesn't like. Now, I know there's also in the UK, I think they actually did – chat, correct me if I'm wrong. I thought they did strip someone of citizenship, but I don't think in the U.S. – I don't know if they were able to. Have you been following that story?
I have been following the story, and I know of absolutely no provision in the Constitution,
right,
or any federal law that allows you to strip somebody of citizenship. And I would point out, right, and as you point out, right, the country is important. Most countries don't have birthright citizenship, but we do. It's enshrined in our founding documents. And so, no, I don't think you can do that. I think the evidence that you can't do that is overwhelming, right? Like we have, we have a rule that says that takes away some of the rights, right? Like felons can't vote in some states. Although, you know, we've talked about the political lobbying to try and roll back some of those restrictions. The fact that you can't strip citizenship of, you know, a serial mass murderer, right, is, you know, I think all the proof that you need to know.
Yeah, I agree with definitely that we shouldn't be doing that. I don't like it as a precedent. I love this. Here, we'll just allow this as a little tease, as you already did. A below average OA. Listener, I forgot that joke, but I kind of am remembering that it was funny. What do you make of Justice Thomas's dissent? We're going to talk about that on Tuesday, I believe. Was that Tim's v. Indiana, right? Oh, no, wait. Oh, no, it might have been a different dissent. Or was that the case?
You haven't gotten to the rest of the question, so I don't know.
Was it Tim's v. Indiana is what I was asking. Was that the name of the case?
Is that the one that he's asking about, or is that the one that we talked about?
I couldn't remember. Oh, you know, let me finish the question. I thought we were just going to do a teaser, but it might be a different one.
Sorry.
My mistake. Dissent in Timms v. Indiana, specifically his argument that the court's use of substantive due process as a means of incorporation has led to some of the – no, that's the one. I can't remember.
No.
Some of the court's most notoriously incorrect decisions. For example, Roe v. Wade, and Dred Scott, because those are the same. Could he, along with Gorsuch and his blurb of a concurrence how could he, along with Gorsuch and his blurb of a concurrence, which also question – what the – this question is unreadable. I'm sorry. It's there's some weird punctuation. Question the use of due process clause as a means of incorporation. Be posturing – okay. Could he be posturing?
I'm going to ignore.
There was a parenthetical that lasted a book that I didn't realize was a parenthetical. Okay. Could he be posturing to take down Roe via reevaluation of the incorporation doctrine and its use of due process of the due process clause? Or am I just a crazy law student pinning strands of yarn to the wall? Sorry that I failed to read your question. Okay. Now that I've finally done it, what do you think?
Okay. So, a couple of things. Number one, the Thomas Gorsuch is a concurrence, not a dissent in Timms versus Indiana. So Timms versus Indiana was 9-0 incorporating the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines prohibition to the states. We talked about how that's an unabashed good thing. We talked about how we predicted that this sort of unites left and right. I think the part of you that is a very perceptive law student here is noticing that Thomas and Gorsuch would have affirmed
that anything they would agree on is probably evil. Is that that's a pretty
yes, but in particular that they would have incorporated out the Eighth Amendment through the Privileges and Immunities Clause and not through substantive due process as part of the right's ongoing effort to gut substantive due process at the federal level. It absolutely is dangerous. It's something we are going to talk about in more depth in an upcoming segment because it's part of what the Howler Monkey contingent on the court wants to do. And even in a case as clear cut as Timms, they can't help themselves from not wanting to commit to print an agreement with anything that that could turn around and actually protect real individual rights for real people down the line. It's scary, and you're really perceptive to have noticed that distinction there, but. It isn't a direct line from that concurrence to overturning Roe v. Wade. It is rather not wanting to have something in the record that could come back to bite them down the line.
All right. And I wish I hadn't embarrassed myself not being able to read in front of Adam. Thank you, everybody, for making me do that. No, it's my own fault. It was a confusingly worded thing. it's 0GP, not PIS. Don't at me. I agree. Asks, when will you do a live episode? Now, do you mean like just live, like we'll just live, or do you mean like a live show in front of an audience? We're trying to. We will. It's just turns out they take a lot of planning and stuff that, two busy guys have a hard time putting together. But we want to. We're going to someday.
We will.
We promise.
We absolutely will.
Absolutely will. We can't tell you exactly when, but we will make that happen.
Thomas, question for you from Liz in the chat room says, what should Seattle name its hockey team?
It's funny because I hated the Vegas Golden Knights. I thought that was the dumbest name. And then – but like because Vegas did such a good job of embracing the team and like the logo was really good, I think, well-designed and the atmosphere was so good. I'm fine with it. So I kind of think whatever, it's less about that and more about how much the city and fans embrace it, But the Seattle Slew, I don't
know. <We'll see. laughs> I like it.
Wait, that kind of works, actually, now that I think about it. No, I don't know. That's going to be interesting, and it makes me – it's so tempting to move to Seattle because I already love it up there and would love to be there anyway, and then it's like – and they have a hockey team coming up. But I also love the Sharks so much that I could never it would be like I would go to every game and still just want it to be the Sharks every time and not even – you know? Anyway.
I like the trend in minor league baseball team names of just going for more and more ridiculous mascots and team names. And
nice.
I think that is it. If it is unintentional meta commentary on, hey, don't take this too seriously, it's a minor league baseball game, I love it. And I think we could use more of that in life. So I would be a fan of, like, you know, the Seattle three guys with a stick, right? Like, or, you know, something like that.
Hopefully they come up with something better than that. so I think we have time for one more question, and I think this will be an interesting one to talk about. We have touched on things like this, but I think it always bears repeating. General Contact Unit Problem Child asks, do you think Trump would have been indicted for something by now if he'd lost in 2016? I'm going to venture a guess and say no, because I don't think we pay attention enough to white collar crime when it really matters. You know, like when it's not the president, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
I agree with you that white collar criminal enforcement is, it is woeful compared to, you know, street crime enforcement. And I would add that there's also a sense in which, had Trump run and lost, that you don't go after the party that lost. You know, that it sort of feels like we had, even when they've committed legitimate crimes.
Yeah, even though the Republicans are still chanting lock her up, like,
well,
to this day. But that's because they're the
again,
worst.
Right,
yeah.
That's what is so right. I mean, that's what's part of the breakdown of you know, not just civility, but norms with this, right? That, like, there's nothing, you know, like that. The Democrats were not talking about Mitt Romney, in 2014, right? Like, it's just you don't.
Counterpoint,
right?
Mitt Romney's not a horrible criminal. I know of.
That you know of, right? Yeah. I mean, like, you know.
No, I agree with you. It's one thing to go after somebody like your defeated rival for, you know, a ticky-tacky, not real, drumming up a scandal kind of stuff. It's another thing, I think, with Trump, where he's just gotten away with everything forever, and because there's no consequences for rich, powerful white men. And I realize I started this off. I'm glad you agree, because I don't think we would have even paid enough attention to care. Now, maybe there were some things here and there. Maybe he would have paid some fines or something, because, you know, he's paid fines for right. Some of the charity stuff. And so, you know, maybe there's enough attention on him.
And you know, that's kind of this was the predicate of the beginning of your answer, right? I wonder how many other ultra wealthy billionaires are as corrupt as Donald Trump, right? Like, if, you know, if one of the Koch brothers had run for president, right? Like, would we find that they have scam charities or is this really, you know, and I don't know which way would be worse. Well, I do know which way would be worse. It would be worse if all billionaires are as bad as
also
Donald Trump.
Kraft just got busted in potential human you know, like prostitution, human trafficking. It's not looking good for billionaires in terms of how likely they are criminals. It's still good for billionaires, but I mean, I think you might be right. And I've said this before too. It's like, it opened a lens. He should never run for president. I'm so glad that he and all the fucking criminals in his administration who have now been indicted are facing finally in their lives some sort of consequences as a result of their arrogance and ambition for doing this entire project. It's the one silver lining, but imagine how much people get away with every day.
And I don't know how to credit the rumors, but I can tell you that in the late 1980s, Then New York Governor Mario Cuomo was widely considered to be, you know, a top tier potential Democratic presidential candidate. And particularly once Gary Hart had Gary Hart happen to him, that the speculation turned to, why isn't Mario Cuomo running for president? And the back channel was always, oh, he's governor of New York. He just has had to make too many deals with, you know, the mafia over the years to run. Now, again, I want to emphasize these are rumors, right? I don't know in any way whatsoever. I do not want to be libeling the memory of Mario Cuomo. And you know, but there was kind of a sense up until Trump of like, if you've done horrible, horrible things and gotten away with it, maybe don't run for president, right? Like, and the idea that like, it just the level of arrogance to have done the things that Donald Trump has done in life and think, eh, well, I could run for president and like no one's gonna find out. Like, I just don't get it.
Yeah. Well, in what other way has he ever faced consequences for anything? So how would he know? All right. Well, that's all the time we have for our live Q&A. Thank you, folks, so much. I think the weekend one was a good idea. I think, you know, more people were able to come.
Decent turnout despite the technical difficulties.
Yeah. And I'm going to have to figure out how to, you know, if they ever get rid of the older section of YouTube that I somehow uncovered. I don't know how we're going to do this. So I'll figure it out. Maybe I can find a way. But thanks, everybody, for sticking with us through that little awkward beginning period. But we always make sure we get the full hour for you guys. Recorded. Yeah. We love you and we'll see you very soon.
All right. Until then.